The thoughts that I'm going to present here today are operating under the title of a pantheon of disenchantment. And they have to do initially with the interest that I have in models of pedagogy of knowledge production and with attempting to position knowledge constitution and pedagogy as a series of ruptures and fissures rather than as continuities. And with an attempt to think of what animates the sort of politicization and critical consciousness of the environment that I work in when it is not explicitly dealing with descriptions of political moments. And so I wanted to try and open out this notion of disenchantment as an attempt really for myself to understand what this entails. My classroom is a pantheon of disenchantment. It echoes with the strong voices of those who have lost faith in how to know and are in the process of trying to self-institute towards another pathway into knowledge, into the acts of knowing, acts of self-initiation or self-inauguration into knowledge, are the performative gestures of this pantheon of which I speak. These voices are the ones that drive our oddly named courses in our undisciplined field, visual cultures, that perform the gesture that stops common sense in its tracks, the gesture of not this, not there, not where it's supposed to be. They perform Deleuze's exhaustion, Foucault's insurrection of surreptitious knowledges, Agamben's whatever, Nancy's being singular plural, and Derrida's supplementarity, Haraway's cyborgs, and Blanchot's power of speech to interrupt itself. The disenchantment I am so drawn to is not a protesting one, though it is profoundly critical. It is not an oppositional one, reproducing the binary logic of antagonistic opposite, though it keeps the enmity of ideas in mind. And it is not a form of resistance, though it does take the form of action rather than of analysis. These voices don't lambast, they don't analyze, they don't explain or refute, and they don't lament or deny. They halt the discussion, refuse natural continuity, and surprise by starting again from the middle, from elsewhere, and otherwise. My fondness for these voices is not that they are novel, certainly not part of cognitive capitalism's endless pursuit of marketable novelty with its bright, promising titles and old, familiar arguments. But perhaps that they perform an uncompromising duality. On the one hand, a critical move of halting the discussion in its conventional mode, and on the other, the possibility of starting it again from elsewhere and differently. I've come to think that being able to halt a discussion without criticizing it, and to inhabit the stoppage as more than an intermediary gap, is the voice of disenchantment. And of course that gap is not simply a stoppage, but it is equally a promise. For disenchantment is placed firmly between the initial enchantment that inevitably preceded it. And the re-enchantment that will inevitably follow it. Inevitably, because once one has, Because once one has the propensity for enchantment and the understanding of its persuasive power, it will take place again and again. Who of us does not remember the first time we read Foucault, or Derrida, or Kristeva, or Haraway, or Deleuze, or Amitav Ghosh, or Michael Taussig, and all of our subterranean frustration with thinking found a break in which to locate itself? The intense pleasure of not reading something and agreeing with it, but of being actualized by it. In part, disenchantment is so important because it follows by necessity the condition of enchantment, a state of persuasion and seduction which fuses rationally conscious thought with affective conviction, a duality of intellectual clarity and emotional entanglement that are crucial for any acts of affecting knowledge. And of course, because it both enacts and insists on the significance of the moment rather than of the long line of tradition. This preoccupation with disenchantment follows on from a question I've been asking myself for some time. Sorry, this is a bit of a tongue twister. If we agree that we only know what we know how to know, what are the mechanisms by which we might catapult ourselves from one paradigm to another, one belief system to another? How might we equip ourselves to move towards that which we don't know how to know? The pantheon of disenchantment that propels and animates the work in my classroom is not only a pedagogical model. It also points me in the direction of what is being called practice-based research, or what I would prefer to think of as creative practices of knowledge. For these two are moments of suspension that move sideways, giving themselves permission to know from elsewhere, rather than to negate dominant knowledge. Recently, the annual lecture series known as the Rees Lectures, commemorating John Rees, the founder of the broadcasting company, began on the BBC. This year, the lecturer was Martin Rees, the president of the Royal Society of Astronomy. He began by looking back to the 17th century emergence of aristocratic, self-taught scientific amateurs who gathered out of passionate curiosity about the world, the natural world, formed societies, exchanged books, reviewed each other's experiments and theorems, and formed the first professional learned associations devoted to uncovering radical new knowledge, such as the Royal Society in 1660, when a dozen men gathered in a pub to hear the young Christopher Wren give a lecture on astronomy. In the discussion that followed, they decided to form a society for the study of the new and still controversial experimental philosophy. The motto they decided on for their new association was, "Take nothing on authority." A motto that still resonates with me today as I try to think about academic protocols and the academic authority of truth regimes, and how these are constantly challenged by creative practices of knowledge. Now, you don't know this, but I am neither naive nor romantic. I do not hark back nostalgically to the 17th century, to privileged amateur men sustained by colonial adventures, indentured laborers, vast estates and arrogant entitlement. But I do want to keep hold of two of their formulations, the value of experimental philosophy and the edict to take nothing on authority. And I think that practice-based research or creative practices of knowledge are some of the ways in which we might grasp these and ensure that they do not cede to the endless pragmatic demands of knowledge protocols. Outcomes, outputs, impact, constant monitoring of the exact usefulness of knowledge or of its ability to follow the demands and the imperatives of cognitive capitalism, to be portable, to be transferable, to be useful, to be flexible, to be applied, to be entrepreneurial, and generally integrated within market economies at every level. Later, the same day that I heard Martin Rees's inaugural Rees lecture, a rather brilliant practice-based researcher at Goldsmiths, the institution that I teach at, underwent what we call the upgrade, which is the passage from the preliminary to the final phase of PhD research. On this occasion, three professors sat in a room trying to convince this brilliant young man that he could do whatever he wanted, since he was clearly both serious in his research and passionate about his subject. We went on saying that he could invent a narrative, decontextualize his objects, speak in any kind of voice, and in general, take as many liberties with his work as served his purpose. He, on the other hand, clung to the conventional academic protocols like a drowning man to a raft. How could he prove this, and how could he ground that? And what did he need to do to be taken seriously by a professional academic community that held him up, he felt, to higher standards of knowledge? There was something both comic and confusing about our trying to liberate him from scholasticism and from his belief that it was some mysterious realm that he needed to crack in order to enter for the formal bastions of knowledge. The first story of aristocratic gentlemen in 17th century London refers to knowledge pre-signification. And the second story of the PhD researcher wanting to be legitimated by scholarship refers to knowledge trying to be liberated from over-signification. And somewhere between these two is the dilemma I'm trying to get at. And I think the creative practices of knowledge are some of the ways in which we might grasp these and ensure that they do not cede to the endless pragmatic demands of knowledge protocols. But my question is whether constantly dealing critically with the structures and with the protocols and with the demands set up by education systems and institutions, which is most of the debate in Europe around practice-based research these days. It seems to be constantly centered around institutional demands, systemic structures, protocols, etc. My question is whether that kind of a discussion is actually going to get us to where we might need to be. Because my concern is not with the systemic structures, but with the actual knowledge, and my belief is in its power. Now, in this state, we move beyond criticism of regimes and players and intentions, and from critique of the underlying political and ideological structures that have captured and seized the conflict, and continue to hold it to ransom to their logics and towards criticality, a condition in which we both see through the conditions of our lives while continuing to live out their difficulties. And this is something that I've been trying to formulate for a while in different contexts. And I'm trying to differentiate between criticism, which is the a sort of a practice in which one is able to produce evaluative judgment, to critique the sort of what underlies much of the post-structuralist project, which has to do with, in some way, focusing on the assumptions that ground certain kinds of claims and allow them to circulate in the world as truth claims, and between what I'm calling criticality, and which for me is the condition of this particular moment. And in criticality, as I understand it, or as I would like to formulate it, has to do with the fact that no matter how theoretically armed we might be, no matter how able we are to see through structures and analyze intentions and recognize gestures, we nevertheless live out the very conditions which we are critiquing. And so this is, to me, a very significant duality in which we need to both be able to analytically see through things and galvanize the language which allows us to recognize the experience of living through them. So this development, this move from criticism to critique to criticality is something that informs a great deal of the way in which I think. In this state, we move beyond criticism of regimes and players and intentions, and from critique of the underlying political and ideological structures that have captured and seized the conflict, and continue to hold it to ransom to their logics, and towards criticality, a condition in which we both see through the conditions of our lives while continuing to live out their difficulties. Now, what do the politics of criticality, so much less directed and goal-oriented than political resolutions, have to offer to the intellectually exhausted? Criticality, as I've been trying to articulate it in recent years, is the tail end of a transition from criticism to critique to a contemporary vein of criticality. A shift from criticism with its inherent value judgments and from critique with its epistemological unveiling and uncovering of assumptions and knowledge regimes to a contemporary state which I would call criticality. Criticality being at once an ability to see through the structures that we are living in and to analyze them in a theoretically informed way, while at the same time to recognize that for all of one's critical apparatus, one is nevertheless living out those very conditions. Of course, criticality has critique enfolded within it, but it is more. It is a conscious duality of both living out something while being able to see through it, and it requires another mode of articulation, one that cannot smugly stand outside the problems and offer a clever and knowing analysis. Instead, it requires that the experiential dimension of what we're living out be brought into contact with the analytical. And of course, one of the reasons I so value a notion of criticality is because it does not allow for either cynicism or sarcasm, which are the ultimate expressions of knowing outsidership. Instead, the need to navigate the terrain at levels of analysis, feeling, and mutuality emerge in what Arendt has so beautifully termed we fellow sufferers. Much of the discussion around creative practices of knowledge is one of institutional protocols. And although I have to deal with it in my daily reality of committees and national founding councils and endless policy making, I do not wish to rehearse these on this occasion. Instead of fighting for alternatives, I wanted this moment to pose questions about the circuits of knowledge that went from amateur to professional, from general to discipline-based, and to currently understanding themselves, at a progressive level at least, as being undisciplined. Obviously, the vast body of thought that Michel Foucault put into play with his historical analysis of knowledge formations and the assumptions that these have been based on has been key here. But we have also been through a decade in which activist initiatives at countering institutional dominance of knowledge production and dissemination have also shifted the ground in terms of expanding the range of the possible formats available for learning. In this instance, I want to pay as much attention to the knowledges themselves as we do to the demands put on them, the structures that house them, the strictures that police them, and the rhetorics they are embedded in. In a series of papers and initiatives over the past couple of years, my increasing focus, I now realize, has been on the move from the formats to the substances of knowledge. There is an argument forming here, I think, that we should not be arguing formats with counter-formats, structures with counter-structures, protocols with counter-protocols, but rather with emergent knowledge formations that have the ability to undo the ground on which they stand. To advocate for creative practices of knowledge is to advocate for its undisciplining. It is to argue that it needs to be viewed as an a-signifying practice that produces ruptures and affects within the map of knowledge. This is difficult since the legacy of knowledge we've inherited from the Enlightenment has viewed knowledge as teleological, linear, cumulative, consequent, and verifiable, either through experimentation or through orders of logic and sequential argumentation. It is slippery to try and talk about the knowledge itself, slippery to avoid essentialism or notions of autonomy, and equally awkward to avoid the heroics that attach themselves to the declarations of the new. In this context, Foucault's insurrection of subjugated knowledges comes to mind, but not necessarily as I think he meant it, in terms of repressed knowledges that come from less normative and less hegemonic positions of class, sexuality, or epistemology. Instead, perhaps a contemporary notion of such an insurrection of subjugated knowledges is to do with their pursuit of unfitting bodies of knowledge from their accepted frames, leaving their place within the chain of argumentation and drawing to themselves unexpected companions, company whose attachment and proximity can provide paradigmatic challenge rather than arguing and supplying affirmation. So this second and last part of this discussion has to do with asignification and singularization. This process of unfitting, which has become very dear to me, this process by which knowledge becomes asignifying knowledge, is, as Simon O'Sullivan has argued, and I quote, "For Deleuze and Guattari, an a-signifying rupture is a process by which the rhizome resists territorialization, or attempts to signify, or name it by an overcoding power. It is the process by which the rhizome breaks out of its boundaries, obviously deterritorializes, and then reassembles or recollects itself elsewhere and elsewhere, obviously re-territorializes, often assuming a new or shifted identity. In the classroom, asignifying ruptures are those processes students employ to avoid being just students. that classrooms used to avoid being just classrooms, that content uses to avoid being just subject matters, and that teachers use to avoid being just teachers. A signifying ruptures are those various processes by which rhizomes proliferate, wallow, accrete, spread, shatter, and reform, disrupt into play, seeming chaos or anarchy. End of quote. So the process by which knowledge assumes asignificatory forms is one that destabilizes its relation to other fixed knowledges and acquires an affective surplus. As part of some 6 years now of work around education and pedagogy, not as institutional structures, but as overarching transformative forces within the field of culture, I've argued that education needs to be engaged with the notion of free. And this in the context of a special issue of eFlux Journal that we did entitled Education Actualized. Now, obviously, it is not the romance of liberation that I have in mind here in relation to free. The kind of knowledge that interested me in this proposal to the university, which I have to say was immediately laughed away and never for a moment discussed seriously, was one that was not framed by disciplinary and thematic orders, a knowledge that would instead be presented in relation to an urgent issue, and not an issue defined by knowledge conventions, but by the pressures and struggles of contemporaneity. When knowledge is unframed, it is less grounded genealogically and can navigate forwards rather than backwards. This kind of unframed knowledge obviously has a great deal to do with what I had acquired during my experiences in the art world, largely a set of permissions with regard to knowledge and a recognition of its performative faculties, that knowledge does rather than is. But the permissions I encountered in the art world came with their own set of limitations, a tendency to reduce the complex operation of speculation to either illustration or to a genre that would visually exemplify study or research, etc. Could there be, I wonder, another mode in which knowledge might be set free without having to perform such generic mannerisms, without becoming an aesthetic trope in the hands of curators hungry for the latest term? Knowledge cannot be liberated, as it is endlessly embedded in long lines of transformation which link in inexplicable ways to produce new conjunctions. Nor do I have in mind the romance of avant-garde knowledge with its oppositional modes of innovation as departure and breach. Nor am I particularly interested in what has been termed interdisciplinarity, with its intimation of movements between disciplines, and which de facto leaves intact those membranes and of division and logics of separation and containment through illusions of sharing. Finally, and I say this with some qualification, neither is my main issue here to do with the disciplinary and professional categories that have divided and isolated bodies of knowledge from one another with the aim of having a heterogeneous field populated by bodies of knowledge akin to the marketing strategies that ensure choice and multiplicity and dignify the practices of epistemological segregation by producing endless new subcategories for inherited bodies of named and contained knowledges. So while we might not be able to liberate knowledge, its exposure to an attitude of disenchantment as discussed earlier, might be a productive rupture. I have recently had a chance to see a range of new works by the Belgian choreographer Anna-Theresa de Keersmacher. In two recent works in particular, I found the force of disenchantment producing a conversation around knowledge competences that greatly interested me. In Three Upsheet, de Keersmacher circles around her deep affection for the last song in Mahler's Songs of the Earth, Upsheet. Her fascination and affection for the work makes her want to engage with it in some form, makes her want to know it through her own choreographic practice. But none of the available protocols actually produce the engagement she longs for. And so her actual longing to engage with a piece of canonical classical music becomes one of the subjects of the work she's making. Is it a legitimate desire? She tells us while sitting on stage that she can't dance it, and she can't sing it despite taking lessons in an attempt to. And she can't engage an orchestra to play it on stage as it is too large, some 110 musicians plus singer. Finally, she tries with a chamber orchestra in which each player dies on stage after performing their solo. And of course, this too does not affect the kind of deep immersion she longs for. In the end, she is sort of dancing around the stage, accompanied by only a piano, and failing visibly at what she had wanted to do, to dance Mahler's Upsheet. This rehearsal of multiple failures focuses on the narrow limitation of the interpretative model. To know something by interpreting it in another medium. It also opens up the very legitimacy of such a passion, and she is clearly somewhat embarrassed by her own overwhelming desire for such a conventional practice. But she deeply loves the piece, continues to be moved by it again and again, and must, she feels, find a path into it, her love of it as legitimate as her inability to come to terms with it, is disruptive of this simple affirmative model. These are the workings of disenchantment, the duality of a push and pull, at once evacuating the value of what one has to hand, while at the same time adhering to the drive to engage with it. De Keersmacher inhabits the rupture she has made manifest. She flails around trying this and that. She lives out the failures of her attempts, but does not give up the drive to engage. She has broken down the practice into components and then stripped those of their convictions. In another recent piece, Sesena, I saw the sunrise part of a two-part piece, the other one being sunset. The stage is inhabited by both dancers and singers. Everyone seems to have abdicated their expertise. The dancers have been persuaded to sing, and the singers have been persuaded to dance, and neither do this particularly well. In the few moments in which each part of the equation do what they were trained to do, we can see the profound difference. But that seems very insignificant in what gives the sense of an investigation of ontology, pure being. At one point, the combined company stand of singers and dancers stand at the edge of the stage, and they all sing to us. They are not performing music. They are being in sound. And the difference between performance and being becomes very apparent in this instance. This abdication of expertise in favor of some form of inhabitation of stage, body, movement, and sound was exceptionally moving for someone like me who does intellectual work, in particular because it was not a withdrawal, not an exit, a named failure. It was a statement that the proficiencies that we have are not up to the task, that we are not defined by them, that they are interchangeable, that the drive to engage is far more important than the ability to achieve. But none of these mean for one moment that one evacuates the stage. It is an instance of a-signifying knowledge, as Guattari longed for, knowledge or proficiency that perform an incoherence, a suspension, the opposite of what is expected of them, but nevertheless mean. This is the practice of disenchantment that I first understood through the thinkers who shaped my own thinking. It is a moment of suspension, but not an exit and not a withdrawal. It perceives this moment of suspension as the subject, but it also keeps one eye cocked towards the possibility of some other form of enchantment, not writing it off and not having an idea of what form it might take. For me, these were moments of re-singularization of dance or choreography through disenchantment, and one of the most poignant instances of just how rich the moment of suspension can be. So in conclusion, while knowledge in the process of asignification produces a spatial and located detachment from its moorings, knowledge in the process of singularization is relational but not necessarily aligned. As Sueli Rolnick argues, processes of singularization, a way of rejecting all these modes of pre-established encoding, all these modes of manipulation and remote control, rejecting them in order to construct modes of sensibility, modes of relation with the other, modes of production, modes of creativity that produce a singular subjectivity. So the potential is that practice-based research might singularize knowledge rather than be neatly placed within its structures, that materials, associations, narratives, methodologies would pursue one another in unconventional modes, invite each other to dance, as it were. Art history and astrophysics, for example, might develop some conversation, not just as bodies of knowledge, but as the narrative structures they are recounted in, as drives, impulses, personal histories, modes of curiosity, conceits of intelligence, etc. Creative practices of knowledge, then, are a permission for knowledge that is tangential and contingent, driven by disenchantment, and whose sociability, as it were, its search for companionship, is not based on linearity and centrality, but on dispersal, on encounter, and on consistent efforts at re-singularization. Thank you.